Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. Americans honor the memory of Reverend Martin Luther King with street, school, and place names, a national holiday, and a national monument. Tavis Smiley appreciates that, but he also knows most Americans can't quote much more than King's most famous sentence in his I Have a Dream speech. Smiley explores the more nightmarish aspects of King's last year of life in his new book, Death of a King, the real story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year. It's a sobering look at how King's efforts to push against cultural limits made him a pariah in the last year of his life. Town Hall and Elliott Bay Book Company presented this talk by Tavis Smiley on September 30th, 2014, as part of their Civics series. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for this recording.
Well, good evening and welcome. As Weir said, I'm Karen Mathis, General Manager of KUOW 94.9, the home of... Yay! The home of NPR news and information in the Puget Sound, and I'm proud to say the home of Tavis Smiley's public radio programs since 2002. Tavis is an amazing individual, and I don't just say that because we both grew up in Indiana. He can legitimately carry these tags after his name of author, commentator, talk show host on radio and television, entrepreneur, advocate, and philanthropist. If you're not familiar with Tavis Smiley, I just don't know how that's possible because he's everywhere. He's everywhere hosting Tavis Smiley on PBS late nights, The Tavis Smiley Show, distributed by PRI for public radio, airing Fridays at 11 a.m. on KUOW 94.9. Tavis has written or co-written 17 books, including the New York Times best-selling memoir, What I Know for Sure, My Story of Growing Up in America, and The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto, a book he wrote with Dr. Cornel West. Tavis has been named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine, and his notoriety leverages impact through the philanthropic work of the Tavis Smiley Foundation, which has garnered numerous awards, including the prestigious Du Bois Medal, the highest honor in the field of African American studies from Harvard University. That is wonderful. But I would say that even more impressive than those accolades are the estimated 6,000-plus young people he has engaged in his Youth to Leaders training workshops. Tonight he joins us to discuss Death of a King, the real story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year. In the 365 days before his assassination, Martin Luther King Jr.'s life was at perhaps its most volatile and difficult point. He was being denounced by the press, rejected by a president, and was a target for criticism from the black middle class and from militants as well. Both his tactics and his character were being questioned. But in order to continue the discussion on race and poverty in America, he needed to rise above it all. Tavis Smiley's new book looks at that year in great detail to give us a new way of thinking about this American hero. So please join me in giving a warm welcome to Tavis Smiley.
Let me start by thanking Karen Mathis for such a wonderful and generous and charitable introduction. That may very well be the second best introduction I've ever received. And I only say second best because I was in Chicago the other day, Karen, and the person to introduce me didn't show up, and I did it myself. That was awfully nice, and I thank you. As Karen said a moment ago, I've been fortunate to write about 17 books now, and I have, for most of those books, been on tour, and I have always insisted with every publisher that I've been with, I've always insisted, as I did this time, that Seattle be on my tour stop list. And so I'm glad. Yeah. Always, always honored and humbled indeed to be back in this great city. And I certainly want to start tonight by thanking KUOW. I say this all the time, and for those who've seen me at Town Hall or other places in this great city over the years, you've heard me say this so many times. And is Jeff Hansen still in the room somewhere? There he is to my left. Karen is the general manager at KUOW. Jeff Hansen's been there for quite a while as the program director, and it is never, ever lost on me. I never, ever lose sight of the fact or forget that when I first signed up for my show on NPR at the time, and as many of you know, I was the first African-American in the history of NPR to have his own daily radio program. And so now there are other African-Americans who've come through the door, but I was the first to have his own program daily on NPR. It shows you how far America still has to go, that I was the first Negro through the door just a few years ago, essentially, to have his first, have his own program, signature program, heard on NPR across the nation 5 days a week. And I want you to know, as I say every time I come to the city, that the very first station to sign up to carry that program was KUOW in Seattle. So Jeff Hansen, I thank you for being on my side all those years later, and Seattle became a sort of test market for what we could do on public radio by challenging folk to re-examine the assumptions they hold, by helping them to expand their inventory of ideas, by using this public radio platform to introduce Americans to each other. Seattle becomes sort of a test ground, and I guess they figured if it worked in Seattle, it might work someplace else. So because it worked so well in this city, other stations started to pick it up, and here I am all these years later because KUOW in Seattle gave me a shot. So thank you again, Seattle, for being there all those years ago. Let me jump right into talking about this book and why the timing of this text I think is so propitious. And I certainly want to leave good time at the end for your questions and comments. I say all the time that part of what's wrong with our country is that we are so often engaged in monologue and not often enough engaged in dialogue. And I certainly want to learn from you tonight and answer your questions to the best of my ability, but I'm sure hear your comments as well that might enlighten, encourage, empower, and inspire me for the rest of this tour. So I want to get to that Q&A as quickly as I can, but let me just take some time to give you a sense of why this book, I think, is so critically important. As you all know, and it's what I love about coming to Seattle, y'all are such a smart group of people in Seattle, so well-read, and I just love coming here to have these rich conversations. So as most of you in this room already know, Dr. King has three principal biographers, Taylor Branch, David Garrell, and Claiborne Carson. And there is no way, I want to acknowledge every time I step to a microphone on this tour, I want to acknowledge that there's no way that this book, Death of a King, could have been written if Branch and Garrell and Carson had not done the heavy lifting of bringing to us the life and rich legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So I couldn't have written my text without them having done all the work they've done. And yet, up until this book, no book has ever looked at the last year of Dr. King's life, literally the last year, the last 365 days of his life, from April 4, 1967 to April 4, 1968. That year is critical, my friends, because I believe that for every one of us in this room, and I'm glad that this place is just packed in here tonight, I'm humbled by that, but for every one of us in this room, for everyone listening or watching beyond this room tonight, we get to know who we really are. We come to know who we truly are in the dark and difficult days of our lives. Somebody say amen. Amen. That's what I thought. It's not just that we learn who we are, but can I tell you something else? You learn who's ride or die, as we say in my neighborhood. You learn who's going to be faithful unto death. You learn who's with you until the end, when you go through the dark and difficult days of your life. And so if you think you know Dr. King, but you don't know him in the dark and difficult days of his life, then you really respectfully don't know Dr. King. And most of us American citizens have no idea of what the dark and difficult days were like for Dr. King. Why? because most of us, I'm in Seattle, so this is nobody in this room, but most Americans, I believe, think Dr. King only gave one speech in his whole life. And then they think the speech only had one line in it. That I want my children to live in a nation where they'll not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I ain't going to ask you to go no further, because I know that's all you know. So I think we act like King only gave one speech in his life. It had one line in it, and then the next day they shot and killed him. That's not exactly how this went. And so for so many of us, we have King frozen in this frame of 1963 August at the March on Washington, delivering that I Have a Dream speech. I was in Memphis the other day on tour, and what an honor it was. And it was a rough and emotional night for me. I've been there so many times, but it was an amazing honor to have been invited back to Memphis to the National Civil Rights Museum, where Dr. King was assassinated on that balcony at the Lorraine Motel, August 4, 1968. So I was asked to come back with this particular book about his life and to lecture at that museum, and of course spent time on my knees in thanksgiving for the life and legacy of Dr. King on the spot where he was assassinated almost 50 years ago at the Lorraine Motel. I raise that only because when I was in Memphis the other night, I said to the audience of Memphians, so many Americans believe Dr. King only gave one speech in his whole life. But in Memphis, y'all know that he at least gave two speeches. For you historians, you get that joke. Dr. King gave the mountaintop speech. I may not get there with you the night before he died in Memphis. So I said to Memphians, y'all know that he gave at least two talks in his life. But we have Dr. King frozen in this sort of frame of 1963. King dies far too young at the age of 39, but he does live 5 years after I Have a Dream. And in that five-year period, he evolves. He changes. He has a different view on life, on America. And that is the part of his life that we have yet to come to terms with. So in 1963, King is talking about his dream. But by the time this book starts, April of 67, he's saying publicly that that dream has become a nightmare. So it's a dream in 63 and 67. It's a nightmare. In 63, he's talking about and fighting for integration. By 67, he is saying to Harry Belafonte and others that I believe for all that we have done to fight for integration, I believe that we have integrated into a burning house. This is King in 67, that we've integrated into a burning house. In 63, he's talking about a dream and trying to hold America to its highest ideals. He has a, if not an optimism, certainly a hope that America can become a nation as good as its promise. And that's all we want in America, is to live in a country that's as good as its promise. The reality is then and even now that the gap between the promise of America and the possibility in America for all our citizens, that gap is still too wide. So Martin is, again, if not optimistic, certainly hopeful about the future of America in 1963. Let me jump ahead and I'll come back. I warn you right now, hold on to your seats. Strap yourselves down for just a second here. In 63, Martin is hopeful about America. He's assassinated on a Thursday night in Memphis on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. One of the last calls he makes from the Lorraine, as you'll see in this text, is back to his church, Ebenezer, in Atlanta, that he co-pastored with his father, Daddy King. King is on the road all the time. But every Thursday or Friday, he calls in the sermon he's going to preach on Sunday morning, so they have time to get it typed up into the Sunday morning bulletin. So when you show up on Sunday morning, they hand you the bulletin with the order of services and the sermon that Dr. King is going to preach that Sunday morning. So one of the last calls he makes from the Lorraine Motel is back to his church, and he tells his secretary and tells his father that come Sunday morning, had he lived, he was going to preach a sermon entitled, Why America May Go to Hell. That was the sermon topic on Sunday, had he lived. Why America May Go to Hell. May is the operative word here. He didn't say America was going to hell. He didn't declare America. He didn't say, go to hell, America. His sermon was going to be why America may go to hell. His thesis was that if we don't get serious about what he'd been talking about for the year prior, as he called it, the triple threat of racism, poverty, and militarism. Martin called it the triple threat of racism, poverty, and militarism. If we don't get serious about this triple threat facing our country, we're simply going to lose our democracy. And America may just go to hell. Now, when you tell the average American that the I Have a Dream man was going to preach a sermon called Why America May Go to Hell, they have a hard time juxtaposing these two persons. They can't quite figure that out. That's because we don't have any real understanding of who King becomes from 1963 to 1967. So he's dead April 4, 1968. Had he lived a few more days, he was going to preach this sermon, Why America May Go to Hell. The thesis, again, was that we've got to get serious about this triple threat of racism and poverty and militarism. So let's back up a year to April 4, 1967, the year prior, when King introduces this notion. So this book is about the last year of his life, April 4, 67, when he gives this speech in New York at the Riverside Church called Beyond Vietnam. He's dead literally 1 year to the day later, April 4, 68. And this is what this text is all about. Just that last year. Who has Martin Luther King Jr. become? What is he up against? What kind of hell and hate is he having to navigate every day? And how does he get up every day and continue to tell his truth with everything coming at him? So it's April 4, 1967. Martin goes to New York to the Riverside Church and gives a speech called Beyond Vietnam. He'd been on the record already opposed to the war in Vietnam, but had not come out and given a major speech explaining his position and declaring that he was publicly against the war in Vietnam. And so Riverside Church becomes the place. April 4, 67 is the date. Everybody in his camp except James Bevel tells him, Martin, do not give this speech. We have to stay focused on civil rights and human rights and voting rights. You're about to get off on a tangent. You're going to mess up everything we have worked for. You're going to anger the president who's been good to us on voting rights and civil rights, Lyndon Johnson, who we have worked with. They gave Martin a litany of reasons why Martin should not give this speech. And Martin got to that podium at the Riverside Church and said, I come to this place tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. Martin says that night that silence is betrayal. Sometimes silence is betrayal. And so I've come to this house tonight to speak out against the war in Vietnam. And then he uses a phrase that got him in a world of trouble. He says that night that America, my country, is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. The greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Now, let me contextualize that for you. First of all, as you well know, you couldn't get away saying that today without catching some hell. But imagine, this is Dr. King. Yes, he's Dr. King. Yes, he's a Nobel laureate, Nobel Peace Prize recipient. But this is still Dr. King, a black man. I want to contextualize this. You got a black man in the 60s who white folk have given license to talk about civil rights, but ain't nobody asked his opinion on foreign policy. What they're saying is, Negro, we gave you license. We gave you the freedom and the right to talk about civil rights, but anybody told you can talk about foreign policy. Stay in your lane. This foreign policy is none of your business. That's what they're saying to Martin, basically. Martin is saying, hold up, I'm against violence here, I'm against violence there, I'm against violence everywhere. So you got Martin King, black man in the 60s, who's already repeatedly by Hoover and the FBI been labeled and called a communist, who stands up at the height of the Vietnam War and says to America, you, America, you are the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. inside the hall, inside the beautiful edifice Riverside, as I look around this wonderful edifice, Martin had 7 standing ovations, applause all throughout the night. The speech was deliciously received on that night. But oh, come the next morning, they went after him with a vengeance. They vilified King the next day. I believe, and I suspect you believe as well, that there is no such thing as an overnight success. But I also equally believe that you can go from being a success to being persona non grata overnight. One day you're on top of the world, the next day you're being crushed by the world. So no such thing as an overnight success. It doesn't work this way, but it can work that way. It can turn on you real fast. And that's what happened to Dr. King. One day he's Dr. King, and the next day he is out of step and out of touch, and everybody in America turns on him the next morning. Now, I was on Fox News the other night talking about this book, and I walked out of the studio, and I kind of chuckled to myself just thinking, what would Fox News have said? What would Rush Limbaugh have said? What would Glenn Beck have said? What would Fox News have done to him the day after he declared that America was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today? Now, Fox News wasn't around then, but that's okay, because the liberal media establishment did their job. The liberal media establishment. When you read this text, Death of a King, and you see what the New York Times said about him, it's embarrassing. When you read what the liberal Washington Post said about him, it's going to upset you and make you mad. When you read about what Time Magazine said about him that week, it might even make you cry. The liberal media turned on him quicker than right now and sooner than at once. They turned so fast on him, his head was spinning. He woke up the next morning, and every major newspaper, every major news outlet in this country was skewering him the very next day. So first, after giving that speech, the media turns on him. And then the White House turns on him. Martin has worked with Lyndon Johnson, as I intimated earlier, to get the 2 most important and, I think, seminal pieces of legislation in the entire 20th century passed, the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. So he's worked with Johnson to get both of these acts passed into law. But now he's butting heads. He's going tete-a-tete with Lyndon Johnson. And for most Negroes in the country, Johnson has been the best friend that Negroes have had in the White House since Lincoln freed the slaves, because he worked so assiduously to get the Voting Rights Act and Civil Rights Act passed. And now Martin is butting heads with Lyndon Johnson. Martin is saying to the president, Mr. President, you called for a war on poverty. I support you in that. But now you're engaged on a war in Vietnam. And Martin is saying that, Mr. President, budgets are moral documents. I love that. Budgets are moral documents. If I can quote that great philosopher, budgets are moral documents. If I can quote that great philosopher, Jay-Z, you can say what you say, but you are what you are. And when you put your budget on the table and we see your priorities, then we know who you really are and what really matters to you, because budgets are moral documents, Mr. President. That's what Martin is saying to Lyndon Johnson. He's saying to Lyndon Johnson that war is the enemy of the poor. War is the enemy of the poor. The bombs that you're dropping in Vietnam are landing in the ghettos and barrios of America's cities. That's what he's saying to Lyndon Johnson. Johnson don't want to hear it. So the White House turns on him. After the media has already turned on him. And then white America turns on Dr. King. Hold your seats again. The last poll taken in King's life, the Harris poll, found that 75%, nearly 3/4 of the American people, thought that Dr. King was irrelevant in the last year of his life. I know your head is spinning. You're having a hard time trying to juxtapose the way we have, how might I put this, deified him in death with the way we demonized him at the end of his life. But those are the facts. 3/4 of the American people thought he was irrelevant in the last year of his life. So the media has turned on him. The White House has turned on him. Johnson continues to meet with other black leaders, but Martin is now disinvited to the White House. And then white America turns on him. And if that's not bad enough, then his own people turned on him. Almost 60% of black people thought he was irrelevant and persona non grata. Almost 60% of his own people. And let me unpack that for you. When I say his own people, I mean, as you'll see in this text, that Roy Wilkins and the NAACP come out publicly against Dr. King. I'm talking about Whitney Young and the Urban League, who come out publicly and castigate Dr. King. I'm talking about Adam Clayton Powell Jr., congressman, who comes out publicly to disrespect Dr. King. There's a story in this text that it pains me to even reference, where Adam Clayton Powell Jr. affords Dr. King to his face, the ugliest kind of disrespect that I could ever imagine. When you read in this text what Adam Clayton Powell Jr. did and said to Dr. King's face, you're not going to believe it. And then Ralph Bunche, the only other black Nobel Peace Prize recipient, the only other black male. King was and still is the youngest to receive the Nobel Peace Prize, but Ralph Bunche had one as well. Ralph Bunche turns publicly against Dr. King. Now, I know I lost you on that one, because you're thinking, like I was thinking when I did the research, how is it that this Negro, Ralph Bunche, has the same Peace Prize that Martin has, and yet he turns on Martin publicly when Martin comes out opposed to a war? Hello? You have a Peace Prize. How are you butting heads with Martin when he's opposed to war? I didn't get it in the research, and I don't get it now, but it goes to show you how much hell and hate King was catching from everybody at that time. If that's not bad enough, Ralph Bunche is on the board of directors for the NAACP with Roy Wilkins. They decide to pass a resolution to condemn Martin King and release that resolution publicly. When Ralph Bunche saw the resolution, the language wasn't demeaning enough. It wasn't tough enough for him. He made the language even worse. He rewrote the resolution to make it tougher and more damning for Dr. King. So Bunche turns on him publicly. Carl Rowan, one of the most famous black journalists of that era, turns on him publicly. He writes a scathing piece in Reader's Digest. You'll see it in the text. Scathing piece he writes about Dr. King. And then the black media starts to turn against Dr. King. And I can't even tell you at town hall tonight, I would dare not quote, but it's in the book, what Thurgood Marshall, yes, that Thurgood Marshall, I can't even quote for you because the language is just too spicy and too saucy. Can't even tell you what Thurgood Marshall said about King, but you'll read it. I will tell you this. I can quote this part. Thurgood Marshall called Martin Luther King Jr. a boy on a man's errand. The worst thing then and the worst thing today you can ever call a black man is what? A boy. Thurgood Marshall called Martin Luther King Jr. a boy on a man's errand. And that's the nicest thing he said, as you'll see in the text. It gets worse from there. So the media has turned on him. The White House has turned on him. White America has turned on him. Black America has turned on him. And then inside his own organization, King can't get a consensus from his own team to support his position against the war in Vietnam. His own board of directors at SCLC, his board of directors, passes a resolution to condemn him. He's on board, condemning him on his position on the war. If that's not bad enough, King had no idea that his treasurer, James Harrison, was a paid FBI informant. His photographer was a paid FBI informant. So he's got folk inside his camp with him every day who are reporting back to Hoover and the FBI every day, reporting on what's happening on the inside. So he's being betrayed and obstructed and catching hell and hate from the inside by his team, which he referred to as a team of wild horses. That's his description of his own team, a team of wild horses. They don't agree with him on the position, his position on Vietnam, and he can't get them to support him on his poor people's campaign that he's trying to get off the ground. So he's catching hell and hate on the inside, catching hell and hate from the outside, and on top of that, he knows he feels the death angel hovering in his space. He knows he's living on borrowed time. He knows there's a bullet out there with his name on it. He knows the death threats are coming every single day. He knows his time is limited. And yet, 2 hours before Martin walks out on that balcony to be assassinated, he says, "I'd rather be dead than be afraid." Not knowing 2 hours later he, in fact, would be dead. "I'd rather be dead than be afraid." Martin says repeatedly, "A man who has not found something for which he's willing to die is not yet fit to live." Martin says repeatedly, "I'd like to live a long life, but it's not about how long you live, it's about how well you live." Martin says repeatedly that the only thing that we have control over is not where we die or when we die or how we die. We only control what we die for. Not the where, the when, or the how. We only control what we die for. So with all this swirling around him, Martin King has to get up every day and somehow muster the courage and the conviction and the commitment to still speak his truth. Now, again, all these years later, we know that King was right. And so, as I said earlier, we've deified him and beatified him in death. But we gave him hell in the last years of his life. As hard as this is to say, as hard as it is to say, I'm going to say it anyway, because I believe it with every fiber of my being. In a very real way, we helped to kill Dr. King. It's a strong indictment. But we helped to kill him. And we helped to kill him because we abandoned him in the dark, difficult, desolate days. We abandoned him. We abandoned him. And so now we're honoring him on the cheap, as it were, with the holidays and the monuments and the postage stamp. His name is on schools, streets, and libraries. His name is everywhere now. We're honoring him on the cheap. But we have yet to come to terms with the truth he was trying to tell, perhaps because it was then and is still now too subversive for us to handle. The truth he was trying to tell us about that triple threat facing our democracy, which still exists: racism, poverty, and militarism. What did we just see on display in Ferguson, Missouri weeks ago? Racism, poverty, and militarism. So we still yet to come to terms with the truth he was trying to tell. So Martin is waking up every day trying to put one foot in front of the other. One day, there's a story in the book, one day he wakes up, gets dressed, fully dressed, puts his suit and tie, socks and shoes on, and he can't get out the door. He walks back in the bed, fully clothed, shoes and all, gets back in the bed, pulls the covers over his head, and he cries and cries and cries until he falls asleep. He's drinking a little bit more than he should. He's smoking a little bit more than he should. He's gaining weight. Let me advance and I'll come back. The autopsy on his body in 68 found that while he was dead at 39, he had the organs, the insides of an almost 65-year-old man. The pressure and the stress was eating him alive. And yet every day he got up and continued to tell the inconvenient, uncomfortable, unconventional, unhousing truth. He did it every day with all that going on. There were times at night Martin couldn't sleep in the last year of his life, as you read in the text. He couldn't sleep. One night, they were in a hotel, 3 o'clock in the morning. Ralph Abernathy wakes up and goes to King's room and he can't find him. King is not in the bed. And Ralph gets scared because the death threats have been really extreme, number one. But number two, Martin has been depressed and a little despondent. And as you'll read in the text, Martin had mania, had a bit of mania. And the psychiatrists tell us today that for those folk who have that kind of mania that Martin had, it helps develop in them a sort of radical empathy. Makes sense to me. Makes sense to you? Because they themselves are so they're struggling with this, their own sense of mortality and their own mania. It actually makes them have a greater sense of empathy for other people. So that mania can lead to a sort of radical empathy. And there's a book coming out next year about Dr. King that's going to be very controversial, a psychological profile of him by a Tufts professor who makes that argument that what allowed him to have that sort of radical empathy was the mania that he suffered. He was depressed and despondent. There were days in the last year of his life he's hospitalized for what they said was exhaustion, and to be sure he was exhausted, but he also had that depression and despondency he was dealing with. You read in the text that when Martin was 12 years of age, he tried to kill himself. As a young child, he tried to commit suicide. I won't spoil the read for you, but you'll read what happened at 12 relative to his grandmother that made him feel responsible. And he goes up to the rooftop of their house and jumped off and tried to kill himself. Thankfully, he lived, but he had that sort of radical empathy even from the time he was just a child. And so Martin is trying to love his way through this, but there are times he can't even sleep. And so because they knew that Martin was suffering from this depression and knew the death threats were real, Ralph got scared at 3 a.m. when he can't find Dr. King. He's not in the bed, not in the bathroom, not in the room, can't find him anywhere. Ralph starts to panic. Then he realized that King was staying in a room that had a balcony that went around to the other side of the room. And he walks out around the corner, and there's Martin standing in his pajamas, looking out at the ocean at 3 a.m, singing a song called Rock of Ages. Rock of Ages, cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. He knew his time was limited. Rock of Ages, cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. And Ralph can't convince Martin to go back to his room because Martin can't sleep, and he's just singing his way through this night. Ralph goes back to bed, comes back at 8 a.m. Martin is still standing in the same place in his pajamas singing Rock of Ages, cleft for me. In the book, you'll see that in the last year of his life, Martin is singing and preaching and praying and pushing and pulling his way through this last year. But every day he still committed, no matter what he had to do. There was talks in his camp. You'll read about this. There was a talk. There was a meeting in New York one night amongst his inner circle. And the conversation centered around whether or not they could convince Dr. King to see a therapist, to see a therapist. And it never happened, and I won't spoil the read. You'll see why it didn't happen. But that conversation happens inside his own camp. They're concerned about Martin. But Martin is telling them that he's of sound mind. He's telling them that my time is limited. I'm not going to be around here much longer. And Coretta doesn't want to hear that. His inner circle doesn't want to hear that. How do you tell somebody that you're about to leave them? They don't want to hear that. But Martin knows that his time is almost up. And that's why he's working so aggressively to get that Poor People's Campaign off the ground. We think of Occupy, and we think of New York and Zuccotti Park. Martin wasn't going to Zuccotti Park. He wasn't going to New York. He was going to be the original Occupy, but he was going to the nation's capital. And he and thousands of others were going to camp out on the National Mall in a tent city they called Resurrection City. He was going to stay there and live there until they embarrassed Congress to do something about the issue of poverty in this country. Memphis was a test case. He was in Memphis to work with the sanitation workers, as you know, on the issue of income inequality and poverty. And that was a test case. But he was on his way to Washington. And they knew that when Martin got to Washington, it was going to be a major embarrassment for the country. And they killed him before he got there. They didn't want that level of embarrassment. Consider this. J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, in the last year of Martin's life, has Martin listed as the most dangerous man in America. Hear that. Martin Luther King Jr., the FBI and Hoover declare, is the most dangerous man in America. Seattle, I ask you, how is it that you can be the most dangerous man in all of America when the only weapon that you are using is love? I think that says something even today about the power and the potency of this thing called love. And let me offer you a Kingian definition. I'll wrap this up. A Kingian definition of what love is. We could have a whole other conversation on another night. Maybe we'll come back one day and talk about this. But there's a great conversation to be had in Seattle about whatever happened to the notion of love in our public discourse. Whatever happened to the notion of love in our public discourse. King put love in the public square. Gandhi put love in the public square. Bobby Kennedy put love in the public square. Mandela put love in the public square. Whatever happened to the notion of love in our public discourse? And by love, all we mean is simply this, that everybody is worthy, that all life has the same equal and precious value. We are all equally worthy just because. Just because. Just because. That's what we mean. We mean that when we say love. We're all worthy just because. Everybody's somebody's child. Everybody's somebody's kid. It matters not how many degrees you have, where you went to school, how much money you make, what kind of car you drive, what your zip code is, who your mom and them are, what your last name is, how much access you have, what kind of hookup you have, who you know, that the color of your skin, that is irrelevant. Every one of us is equally worthy. All life is precious and has the same value. Nobody's any better than you. Nobody's any worse than you. Life has the same value just because. We're all worthy just because. Now, can you imagine how different our country would be, how transformational it would be if we could ever take that definition and operationalize it? Implementize it in our public policy? Are y'all still with me? If everybody's worthy just because, that means everybody ought to have a job with a living wage. If everybody's worthy just because, everybody ought to have access to high quality health care. If everybody is worthy just because, everybody ought to have access to an equal, high-quality education. If everybody is worthy just because, y'all ain't feeling me on this, that would fundamentally change our nation. If we could ever operationalize that Kingian definition of love, that everybody is equally worthy just because. And so that's why Martin is up every day, trying to love and serve people. I have a simple definition of leadership. I told an audience today at Microsoft, if you call yourself a leader and look behind and ain't nobody following you, you just out for a walk. you just out getting some exercise. But leadership is this. Here's my definition. And when I think of it, I think of King as Exhibit A, the quintessential example of my definition of leadership. You can't lead people unless you love people. And you can't save people unless you serve people. That's leadership. You can't lead if you don't love. You can't save if you don't serve. So if you would call yourself a leader or would be a leader, all I care about is, one, what is the depth of your love for everyday people? And secondly, what is the quality of your service to them? What's the depth of your love? What's the quality of your service? That's what leadership is all about, loving and serving people. And by that definition, I regard Dr. King, and I dedicate this text to Martin Luther King Jr., America's greatest democratic small d, America's greatest democratic public intellectual. So all these years later, we still don't know who Martin King really was. And that's what this book is all about, taking you inside the dark and difficult days of his life, which happened to be for him the last year, where he had to wrestle with who he really was and what kind of immutable principles he was really going to live his final days by. And so I hope that, like me, when you read this text, if you think you love Martin, if you think you respect Dr. King, oh, you're going to really love him. When you see how he navigated through this last year with all that hell and all that hate coming at him, he never bowed, he wouldn't bend, he wouldn't break. And if you love him now, you're really going to love him when you see what he went through with all that hell and hate coming at him in the last year. I close on this note. It's not just to look back at the history of the last year of his life, But I hope and believe that this book will also be a cautionary tale for those of us who are alive today. Why cautionary tale, Tavis? Glad you asked. There's a huge price that our society pays, a huge price that we pay, when we ignore our truth tellers. We pay a heavy price when we ignore our truth tellers. And in Seattle and beyond, there are truth tellers every day trying to get us to deal with the truth of what we're doing to the environment. Global warming and climate change, that's not a joke. But we are turning a deaf ear and a blind eye to the truth tellers among us who are trying to get us to get serious about the environment. We're turning a deaf ear and a blind eye to the truth tellers who are trying to get us to see that poverty is now threatening our very democracy, that poverty is now a matter of national security. 1% of the people cannot continue to own and control 40% of the wealth. The top 400 richest Americans, 400 individuals, have wealth equivalent to the bottom 150 million of us. These days, there's a sidewalk, there's a highway into poverty, but barely a sidewalk out. That's what we're dealing with today. One out of two Americans is either in or near poverty. You've got the perennially poor, you've got the near poor, and you've got the new poor. And the new poor are the former middle class. These numbers are not sustainable. Call it a plutocracy, call it an oligarchy, but this ain't no democracy. And these numbers are not sustainable. We ignore the truth tellers talking about income inequality and poverty. We ignore the truth tellers talking about immigration. And while meaningful reform has to happen, we ignore the truth tellers about this drone program on steroids. We ignore those truth tellers as well. There's a huge price that our society pays when we ignore the truth tellers. So this is not just my love letter to Martin King, although it is indeed my love letter to him. But it's also a cautionary tale. When I was 12 years of age, I was brutally beaten, as I discuss in my text, what I know for sure, one of my previous books. My father snapped one night, and I was so brutally beaten as a 12-year-old kid that I was in the hospital for 2 weeks, 2 weeks in traction. And for some reason, I don't know why to this day, a member of my church, a member of the church came to visit me, and he brought me a box. And the box contained nothing but LPs. Turns out that Berry Gordy of Motown fame had the good sense to send an engineer around to follow Dr. King as he was giving speeches. And he recorded a lot of those speeches. And years later, Gordy put a lot of those speeches out on LP. And this deacon in my church was collecting those LPs. And for whatever reason, I do not know why, he came to me and gave me this gift box with all these recordings in it. And when I got out of that hospital, and I heard the love in his heart and the hope in his soul, it gave me a reassurance. I was mad at everybody. I hated my father. I hated my mother. I hated the world. I'd been accused of something that I hadn't done. My father never even asked me had I done it. The minister of my church stood up in front of the entire congregation and just demonized me. Demonized me in front of the whole church. I didn't know what he was even talking about. My father snapped, and what happened happened. He got arrested and had to go to court and all of that. But I heard King's voice. He was talking to an entire nation about the power of love. Not the love of power, but about the power of love. King was saying that love is the only force in the world capable of turning an enemy into a friend. King was talking to the country, but he might as well have been talking to a 12-year-old broken-hearted, broken-spirited boy, broken-boned boy named Tavis. And what I heard King saying to me is that love is your only option, that you're going to have to find a way to love your way through this, that hatred and bitterness and revenge, Tavis, are not options if you want to live a life of meaning and purpose and value. And since I was 12, all I've tried to do is my small part, and this book is another down payment on that. Just tried to make the world safe for his legacy. I turned 50 a few weeks ago, and I told my publisher, Little Brown, last year, I didn't want this book out in January around his birthday. I didn't want it out in February in Black History Month. I didn't want to blackenize Dr. King. I didn't want it out in April around his assassination anniversary, because I believe that his martyrdom has undermined his message. And so I don't want to get caught up in trying to celebrate a text that gets caught up in all that celebration and pomp and circumstance. But I wanted the book to come out in September for two reasons. One, I would have a clear lane, unobstructed by all these holidays and celebrations, to get you and get us to focus on who Martin King was, absent all the other hoopla. That's the first reason. But the second reason was, it's my love letter to Dr. King. I wouldn't have made it to 50 if he had not saved my life at the age of 12. He'd long since been dead, but he really brought me back to life when I was a 12-year-old kid. And all I can tell you is that from that day until now, I've been doing my small part. When you hear me on radio or see me on television or any place else, all I'm trying to do is my small part to make the world safe for his legacy. And what is that legacy? Justice for all, service to others, and a love that liberates people. Justice for all, service to others, and a love that liberates people. Thank you for listening. I appreciate it. All right, there's a microphone here, there's a microphone there. We're going to take a few questions, as many as I can, and then I'm going to sit and sign all your books and have a good time here. Thank you, Seattle, for coming out, and I appreciate you listening, and now let me listen to you. Yes, sir, questions or comments, we'll start here.
Thank you. Is this on?
Yes,
sir. I think so. Thank you very much for your talk, and especially for your talk about love. Would you be willing to talk about the only trial ever held in the assassination of Martin Luther King? That found that there was a conspiracy to kill him involving governmental agencies?
Yes. I've always believed that there's no way that James Earl Ray could have done this all by himself. Having said that, this book does not address that only because the book starts April 4, 67, ends April 4, 68, although it ends with King being shot on that balcony. There's an epilogue to the book that I think is probably the best part of the book. Do not read the epilogue first. Don't want to spoil it for you. It's a powerful epilogue, I think. But the book ends when King is assassinated, so it's probably the only book that doesn't mention, a book about King that doesn't mention James Earl Ray, because we tell the story from his perspective. And don't be scared tonight when you get home and start reading, because you will not find Dr. King in this book referred to as Dr. King. To his friends and to his colleagues, his co-workers, he was Doc. And to you on page one of this book, he's Doc. The book moves really fast. It's like a movie. It's like a screenplay. We put you in King's inner circle. You are right there in his space. And everything that Doc experiences in real time over the last 12 months of his life, you are right there with him every step of the way. And I think you'll appreciate being in that space with him and experiencing what he experiences. But you start on page one with Doc about to get to the podium at Riverside Church. And you hear what's going on inside his head and how afraid he is, because he knows he's going to get some hell and some pushback. He doesn't have any idea how bad it's going to be. But we put you in his space, and you're with Doc every step of the way. So the book does not talk about James Earl Ray or the assassination, because when Doc is assassinated, the story ends for him, and you're in the space with him. And so when he goes, the story ends. But since you ask, I'm happy to tell you that I've never believed that James Earl Ray could have done that by himself. Yes, sir.
It's a little strange to be asking you questions after hearing you ask so many questions. And knowing how hard you work, we actually loved, I'm the first to say it tonight, we love seeing you on that Dancing on the Stars. And seriously, thank you for your, not only your voice, but your good humor in the global community. coming from a background where I spent 4 years in Prince Edward County, the last legal stronghold, or one of the last legal strongholds of segregation, and spending 2 years in the projects when they're literally in the ruins of the Ida B. Wells projects on the south side of Chicago. Come to Seattle, I was pretty shocked by how polite and well-packaged the injustice can be. And it's... And so it's challenging, and I guess, yeah, my question to you is how can we wake up from teaching a speech and start living the dream?
It's a powerful question, and my short answer is this, and King believed this, that people would rather see a sermon than hear a sermon. They'd rather see a sermon than hear a sermon. And so you have to be, as you already are, continue to be a living epistle of those things that you believe. I believe that every one of us has to be, and clearly you are, every one of us has to be committed to living a life in search of truth, in search of the truth. If there's any lesson that comes from King's life relative to your question, it is that every one of us has to commit ourselves to seeking the truth and then speaking the truth and then standing on the truth and staying with the truth. You got to seek it and speak it and stand on it and stay with it. That's the only way that you become that sermon that people need to see. And I believe even today that courage is still contagious. Courage is still contagious when people see that you're bringing those truths out and you're committed to telling those truths, and it can be contagious. But what's wrong with our society is not enough folk are seeking the truth, let alone speaking the truth. And nobody wants to stand on it because everything and everybody is up for sale. We're like commodities to be bought and sold. Everybody's up for sale. So it's hard to seek it and speak it and stand it and certainly staying with it. That's the message of King's life. I love how you put that. It's polite and packaged. And that's just not, for the record, that's not just here in Seattle. That happens across the country. And that's why we have to be the truth tellers that we need to be, because, again, not enough of us are really willing to have the courage to do that. Thank you for your question. I appreciate it. Yes, sir.
My question is regarding a controversial cartoon called The Boondocks. Mm-hmm. Now, this show, episode 9 of season 1, is called Return of the King. Now, in this show, Dr. King comes back from a coma and addresses the world on 9/11, the war in Iraq, and then, of course, the black community, the current state of the black community. Mm-hmm. I know you've seen this show because they reference your character. They reference you on the show. Mm-hmm. how accurate do you think that Dr. King's opinion was on those topics? And what do you think he would have to say in light of today's topics, in light of Ferguson and everything going on in today's community?
Great question. If King were here today, and I'm always loath to speak for him, but when you read the book, you'll see that he speaks very clearly for himself. And what makes him so powerful is that he's not a politician, he's a prophet. He's prophet, he's prophetic. And so it's clear to me what King would have been saying here. If he were alive today, he'd still be continuing his critique of the triple threat: racism, poverty, and militarism. That's what we saw in Ferguson the other day. Racism, poverty, and militarism. Were he here, he would have, no doubt in my mind, campaigned for Barack Obama, voted for Barack Obama, celebrated Barack Obama's election, and then become his number one critic. He would have done that. I say that because in the text, as you'll read tonight, the closest thing that King ever got to seeing a black president was seeing the first black mayor of a major American city elected, which turns out to be Carl Stokes in Cleveland. King goes to Cleveland repeatedly to campaign for Carl Stokes. So there's no doubt in my mind that he would have campaigned for Obama as he did for Stokes and celebrate Obama's election and then, of course, become, as I said earlier, his critic. When you get to the story about Carl Stokes, I don't want to destroy or spoil the read for you, but look at what Carl Stokes does to Dr. King to his face. Well, let me just tell you. King goes to Cleveland many times to campaign for Stokes. The night of the election, King is in Cleveland to celebrate with Carl Stokes, and the campaign headquarters is the election night headquarters at the Sheraton Hotel. King has a room in the Sheraton. Carl Stokes, about to be declared the mayor of the city of Cleveland, comes to King's hotel room and tells King, Doc, stay close tonight because when I win, which I believe I'm going to, I want to call you up on stage to stand next to me. I want to acknowledge you, to thank you publicly, but I want you on that stage with me. That's what Carl Stokes says to King to his face in King's room. Carl leaves the room, goes downstairs, declares the winner. And I will tell you, in 2014, Dr. King is still waiting on that phone call. Because Carl Stokes lied to King to his face. Told Martin, I want you to come stand next to me on the podium. I want to acknowledge you. Carl Stokes realized a few minutes later that the last thing he really wanted was to be seen standing next to Dr. King in a photo. I say that to give you some sense, again, of the context of how despised and how toxic King was, that black leaders didn't even want to be seen standing next to him in a photograph, So were he here, he would have voted for Obama, as I said, campaigned for him, and then become his critic. On the issue of racism, very quickly, let me just do this right quick. On the issue of racism, he would have critiqued Obama, as I believe he should have been critiqued. Obama had a major moment on Ferguson, and it was an epic fail on his part, an epic fail, as far as I'm concerned. I could be wrong. I don't think I am. It was an epic fail. Left to their own devices, politicians too often end up being garden variety politicians as opposed to statesmen. Left to their own devices, they end up being transactional but not quite transformational. When Barack Obama was running for office and race was an important issue, he took the time to write a major speech on race. Y'all remember this? Everybody loved his speech on race when he was running, and he couldn't run away from it any longer. He tried to run from it the entire campaign. When he couldn't run no more, he gives a speech about race in America when he's campaigning. But now that he's president and he doesn't want to deal with it, Eric Holder gets the phone call. So as the Washington Post said the other day, since Holder has been the black man that Obama wouldn't be or couldn't be, does that mean for the next 2 years ain't nothing going to be said since Holder's going to be gone? The point is that he talked about race and it was in his best interest and avoided it on Ferguson when he could have been a statesman on that issue. Epic fail on Obama's part, and King, I think, might have critiqued him on that. On the issue of poverty, this is real easy. Obama was in office 6 years before he finally got around to giving a major public policy address on income inequality and poverty. And y'all saw it just like I did. He just gave the speech last December. So you were in office 6 years before you finally get around to declaring that income inequality and poverty are the defining issues of our time. He was right with what he said. He was right when he finally got there, but it took him 6 years to get there. Do you honestly think that Dr. King would have stayed quiet for 6 years waiting for Obama to say something on poverty? Absolutely not. And on militarism, we ain't even got to talk about that. You know what his critique would have been on what we're dealing with right now. I said the other day, it got me in some trouble, but I'll say it again. I said the other day, I wonder what that bust of Dr. King in the Oval Office must be whispering to President Obama late at night when he's making his war plans. What must that bust of King be whispering to President Obama late at night when he's in the Oval Office making his war plans? We have a war president with a peace prize, and those are two very difficult things to navigate. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for being here tonight. I brought my sons because I felt it was important for them to hear you and to see you. We listen to you on the radio and we watch you on TV. They're
wonderful.
Nodding off, but they're here. They heard part of it. So thank you for being here. I've got two questions, if that's okay. You and Dr. West are maybe the only two people other than clergymen that I hear talking about, you know, love. Not a lot of, you know, national figures talk about love in the way you two do. And I get it. I understand. But the culture of this country, do you think most people understand what you're talking about?
They do in Seattle.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And then secondly, Do you have different or higher expectations for the president than you've had for other presidents?
Good question. Let me answer both very quickly. On the issue of love, they might not get it, but we're going to keep telling them until they do. We're going to keep talking about it until they do get it. That's why I said it's a whole conversation we could have about whatever happened to the notion of love in our public discourse. So if they don't get it, I understand that, but we got to keep talking about it until they do get a better understanding, number one. On your second question, do I have a higher expectation of Obama? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. As your question suggests to some degree, and I think many people know, speaking of persona non grata, I have been that inside of Black America for a lot of people for the last 6 years because I've been, as they say, hating on the president and jealous of the president and too tough on the president. And I've been called everything but a child of God by a lot of Black people for the last 6 years just for trying to hold the president accountable. And what always, quite frankly, irks me, I answer your question tonight, but I don't ever take time to respond to detractors. While y'all talking, I'm grinding. And so I don't waste my time responding to detractors or haters or deniers. I don't have time for that. I got to get my work done. Having said that, since you asked, let me answer it this way. Black folk forgot, or apparently some of them never knew. I've been at this for 25 years. And when Bill Clinton was president, and I love Bill Clinton, but when Bill Clinton was president and he signed that crime bill where you got to get caught with 100 times more powder than crack cocaine for the same sentence, I ripped him on that, on Tom Joyner and on BET. When Bill Clinton sandbagged Lonnie Guinier at the Justice Department, I went after him. When he signed that welfare deform bill that now is pushing more women and children into poverty, I went after Bill Clinton. When Bill Clinton didn't get into Rwanda to stop the genocide, I really went after Bill Clinton. And that's just Bill Clinton. I really ain't got to make my case on the Bushes, you know. So everybody just conveniently forgot that when Clinton was wrong, I checked him. But then Obama shows up, and I'm all of a sudden not supposed to say nothing. And I get asked if I got a higher expectation. No, I got the same expectation. Negro, do what you said you was going to do. My expectation is the same. Just, I voted for you twice. I tell people all the time, put down the crack pipe if you think, do you really think I voted for John McCain and Sarah Palin? Do you really think I voted for Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan? I voted for Obama twice just like you did. And he's the first Black president. I don't want him to be the last. But he's got to be held accountable. I say all the time, great presidents are not born. Great presidents are made. They have to be pushed into their greatness. There is no Abraham Lincoln if Frederick Douglass ain't pushing him. There is no FDR if A. Philip Randolph and Eleanor ain't pushing him. There is no LBJ if there's no MLK pushing him. And so great presidents have to be held accountable. I got a simple rule for Obama, simple rule when it comes to how I engage him. I respect the president. I will protect the president against white supremacist racist attacks. So I respect him, I protect him, but I will correct him when he's wrong. And that's how I deal with Obama and any other president. So it's not a matter of having higher expectations. Here's the bottom line. And we ain't ready for this conversation right now. We're not ready right now. But when Obama is finally out of office, we're going to have a serious come to Jesus meeting, sister, in Black America. And the first item on the agenda is going to be, was the price of the ticket too high? We got a lot of symbolism, but not much substance. I'm not blaming all this on Obama. That's not my point. So tweet it right. Facebook it right. I'm not blaming all this on Obama. What I'm saying is that the data indicates clearly, not because I said it, go to the census data, I'm giving you sources. Go to the Pew Research Center, go to the Kerwin Institute at The Ohio State University, and a litany of other places I could give you. The data is already indicating that when Obama is out of office, Black people will have lost ground in every single leading economic indicator category. In every category, we will have lost ground. Now, that's not all his fault, but the Bible that I read says you have not because you ask not. And in the era of Obama, we ain't made no demands. We've been so deferential to him. We know he's catching hell and hate. I get that. But we've been so deferential, we've not made any demands. Now, how are we going to explain this to our offspring? That in the era of the first black president, we lost ground in every category. I can't abide that thought. And in part, it's because we didn't make any demands. And it's in part because our so-called black leaders have been silenced and sidelined by this White House. Martin King went to the White House all the time to talk to Lyndon Johnson. He never came out pushing Johnson's talking points. Our black leaders go in ostensibly representing our best interests, and they come out pushing his talking points. And so we have not said anything. We are his most loyal constituency, and we are the group of Americans who have lost the most ground in his term, two terms. And that's what saddens me. I tell folks all the time, I don't hate Barack Obama, I just love you. And because I love you, I'm going to fight for the best interest of all of us as American citizens, but especially for African Americans. So no, my expectation is not any higher at all. I just want Barack Obama to do exactly what he said he was going to do. And when he's right, I'm with him. And when he's wrong, I just try to check him. Hope that answered your question. I thank you very much. Yes, sir.
I did not know that Martin Luther King was the number one most dangerous man on the FBI's list. And that's shocking for me to hear. And it makes me think of the Edward Snowden revelations and the new surveillance technologies that are being developed. And I wonder if you feel that those can be used as instruments to silence truth tellers in our society.
The answer is yes. At the risk of getting in more trouble again, I'll repeat something else I said the other day that I got in trouble for, but I'll repeat it again. It may be very, I've said this on ABC on This Week with George Stephanopoulos, and all hell broke loose. Fox News lost their minds when I said this. and that's the fun of it. But I said the other day that it is quite possible that in 25 years, not today, like I said about black folk, we can have a come to Jesus meet when Obama's out of office. Timing is everything. It is quite possible, my dear brother, that in 25 years, Edward Snowden may be on a postage stamp. He may be on a postage stamp. Yeah. There are too many of us that can't handle, we ain't ready for this right now. But down the road, when we see what came of this, let's be honest, Edward Snowden has pushed Barack Obama. I was just talking about that. You got to push presidents into their greatness. Snowden made all of them reassess a whole lot of stuff. And so down the road, I think we'll appreciate him in a way then that we don't now. But this surveillance state that we live under scares me. It scares me very quickly. One of the beautiful things about writing this book, because Martin, there are a lot of things I didn't get to tonight because time is so limited. But Martin is a very funny guy. You're going to see him in this book having a lot of fun in certain moments in his life. It's a funny story about the night he went to see Ike and Tina Turner open for Sam and Dave. Hilarious story. One night, Harry Belafonte is guest hosting on The Tonight Show for Johnny Carson. He's on there, and King was a really funny guy. I told a joke that just killed on The Tonight Show. You'll see that in the book. So King has a personality that he doesn't want people always to see because he doesn't want to be joking in public and make people think that his work is not being taken seriously. And so there's a lot of good stuff in this book that will make you love King even more. But the most joyful thing that just brought me a sublime sort of joy about researching this book is that Martin turns out to be exactly who I thought he was. He turns out to be as advertised. And what I mean by that, to your question about surveillance, is that for all the hours of surveillance, for all the hours of wiretapping, for all the audio and videotape, not one single solitary time, not one time over all those years, do you ever hear Martin on tape contesting the humanity of any other human being? Nothing derogatory, nothing derisive, nothing demissive, nothing dismissive, nothing demonizing. What you hear on these tapes is Martin feeling sorry for his haters and praying for his detractors. My point is that love thing was a part of his DNA. Now, in this book, you will see that Martin was a public servant, not a perfect servant. He made mistakes. He had shortcomings and faults and frailties, and all that's in the text. We don't kind of cover that up. He was not human and divine. He was just human. He made a bunch of mistakes. But where that love thing is concerned, not one time, I'd hate to know what they would catch me on tape saying. But not one time do we ever hear Martin being anything other than what we expect. That love that he talked about in public was the same love that he had in private. And so even though they had him under surveillance all the time, he was consistent to who he was. But it troubles me when I see polls and surveys and studies by the American people who suggest, well, I ain't got nothing to hide. So I don't care if it's about fighting terrorism, why not? I've got nothing to hide. As we all know, that's a slippery slope. And I get concerned when I see these polls and surveys that suggest that Americans don't really care about that the way I wish that they did. But the answer is to your question is yes. Thank you very much. Let me finish up these last questions and sign these books. Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Mr. Tavis. Good evening. Good evening. My name is Karen Vargas. I come from Kitsap County, better known as Kidnap County. Mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to say is you said when silence is betrayal. Uh-huh. And you also said when conscience leaves me no choice. Mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to ask you, because I know that you're working with youth to leaders, mm-hmm. How are we dealing with from the school to prison pipeline? Yeah. And what are we doing and what message are we conveying to our young people when it comes down to poverty and those that are being targeted and how racism plays into the dynamics of that school to prison pipeline? And what are we doing as a people to really address that?
Let me answer the question this way. Not enough. The last time I was here in Washington State, I was here last filming a primetime special for PBS about that very issue, about this, about the way we're treating young people in our school systems. And I spent a lot of time here in the state of Washington and traveled the country to talk to young people caught up in this system. And if you haven't seen that special, go to PBS. You can download it. It was a wonderful special that we did. And a lot of it was filmed on location here in the state of Washington. But the truth of the matter is that there are a lot of people now, slowly, who are starting to rethink that. Because after Columbine, we instituted this zero tolerance policy. And as a result of that, our kids have been so criminalized now in school systems that the stuff that I used to get sent to the principal's office for, you end up in front of a judge now. I got sent to the principal's office. Now you go in front of a judge and you end up with a criminal record as a 12, 13, 14-year-old kid. You got a criminal record. And so we've so criminalized, and I might add so demonized these young people, that school-to-prison pipeline has become ever more clogged. But thankfully, the evidence I see is starting to suggest that we're starting to rethink the way we are maltreating our children. Still not enough being done. And there's some good work being done here in the state of Washington. I saw a lot of white kids in Washington who were caught up in that. But I saw a lot of wonderful programs. As a matter of fact, there are two programs in the state of Washington that we cited as two of the best examples for how to deal with this problem of the school to prison pipeline. So I invite you to go to PBS and you can download the documentary. Now it aired a while ago, so you can download it and kind of see. But the answer is we're not doing enough. Dr. King, to take it back to the book, cared about young people. He had become sort of out of touch with young people at the end of his life. He was being marginalized by a lot of people. But Newark is burning, Detroit is burning, Watts is burning, and the young people in his day wanted something more radical than nonviolence. They wanted black power. So they'd rather hear Stokely Carmichael and H. Rap Brown and Huey P. Newton than Dr. King. King's point was black power is a great slogan, it just ain't a strategy. Just not a strategy. So there's a lot of work to be done today. And I can tell you this, given what you'll see King saying in this text, he'd have a damning indictment of the way we're abandoning our children today. The way we treat our children makes a major statement about this country, and we ought to be ashamed on so many fronts, principally starting with this one, of the way we're underserving and underloving our children today. Thank you for your question. I appreciate it. Yes.
Unfortunately, we only have time for one more question.
I'm going to squeeze both of them in. One here, one here. Okay, and we'll be done. Okay.
Just make yes. Our one together. I'm going to let my daughter go first.
Okay.
Did you know Martin Luther King?
Did I know Dr. King? No, I did not. I was 3 and a half years old when Dr. King was assassinated, so we weren't boys, yeah.
My question is, it's heartbreaking because I've been to Memphis before. Mm-hmm. I've been to Batesville, Mississippi before. And this time around, I went there, and I, as a journalist, mm-hmm. I felt... I can't explain it. I felt wrong that I didn't know. I didn't realize where I was going when they took me. These people have took me on tours of the city all the time. But walking down that pathway of the civil rights, you know, where he died, a lot of us didn't cross the street. It took all my might to cross the street. And I just had to, and there were so many different colors and races and, you know, everything there. And it had nothing to do with racism, how I felt. It had nothing to do with anything. I was just debilitated, and I didn't know what devastated meant until I was right there. And so my question to you is, as you're discovering these, all this discovery, how do you keep from getting angry, and how do you, you know, I had to write it down because I'm so emotional. How do you deal with the facts discovered, and how do you stay free of feeling helpless?
Yeah.
You know, I brought my kids here today, and I need to fight that in the wake of Mike Brown and everybody. And how do we not get angry?
Yeah.
How do we stay focused to the task? Mm. You discovered all this.
Yeah.
You know, and I need to know.
Yeah. First of all, I want to make a distinction between anger and righteous indignation. Two different things. So the anger might not serve you well, but there's absolutely nothing wrong with being righteously indignant. I'm all for righteous indignation, all for that. So I don't want, what I'm saying to you is I don't want you to not feel something that you naturally feel. Nothing wrong with feeling that sort of righteous indignation. Martin King felt that every day, a righteous indignation against racism, against poverty, against militarism. He wasn't angry, but there was a righteous indignation. So one, I want you to embrace that and not be afraid of that, number one. Number two, there is a distinct difference between, I said this earlier today in a conversation, a distinct difference between optimism and hope. I hear what you're going through as a parent and trying to stay optimistic about your children's future and about what you're up against as a family. Optimism suggests to my mind there's a particular set of facts or circumstances, conditions. There's something you can see, feel, or touch that gives you reason to believe that things are going to get better. By that definition, black folk have never had reason in this country to ever be optimistic, ever. Now, I don't mean to proselytize, but I think even those who are atheists or agnostics or anything else can understand my point. One of my favorite Bible verses simply says that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And so Martin wasn't really an optimist, and I'm not an optimist, but I'm always a prisoner of hope. I'm exhibit A, that you can build a whole life on hope. Now, there may not be reason to be optimistic given what you're looking at, but there's always reason to be hopeful. What I fight against and what you have to ward against is getting to a point of feeling a sense of a hopelessness. When we get to a point of feeling hopelessness, then the jig is up. The game is over when you get to a point of hopelessness. But there's no reason why you should ever get to that point, ever, ever get to that point. One, because we as a people have survived so much worse than this. You're going to tell me that we got through slavery and we got through segregation and we can't navigate our way through this? Our ancestors would be ashamed of us and turning over in their grave that we're going to throw our hands up after all that we've been through. So we've been through so much worse, number one. Number two, this is going to be hard for some of y'all to swallow. I'm going to say it anyway. There are some things in life more important than living. Think about that when you go home tonight. There's some things in life more important than living. In other words, as I said earlier, you got to live your life by a certain set of immutable principles. And whatever the consequences are for putting that truth in your children and exposing your children to that truth, whatever those consequences are, you got to deal with that. But that's why I said earlier, you got to constantly be in a search for truth and seek it and speak it and stand on it and stay with it. But you got to be in that search. And finally, I would just say that that it's about excellence. It's about excellence on your part and instilling in your children a desire to be excellent at what they do. In the last year of his life, Martin King is talking about this everywhere he goes, about our people. You know, we got the voting rights. By the time he dies, we've had voting rights and civil rights. What he's talking about everywhere he goes is a pursuit of excellence. And in our community, too many of us have gotten away from being committed to the pursuit of excellence in everything we do. Martin put it this way: if it falls your lot in life to be a street sweeper, sweep the streets like Michelangelo painted pictures. Sweep the streets like Beethoven composed music. Sweep the streets like Shakespeare wrote poetry. If it falls your lot in life to be a street sweeper, you sweep the streets so well that when you die, all of heaven will have to pause and say, "Here lived a great street sweeper." And then he went on to say something that I want to offer to all of us again tonight, that whatever your calling or avocation is, whatever your purpose or role in life is, Martin says to all of us, and you remember this and put it in your kids, that whatever you are called to do in this world, you should engage your work and your witness and do your job so well. Do your work so well, said Martin, that the dead, the living, or the unborn couldn't do it any better. That's a high standard. Can you imagine waking up every day and committing yourself to do whatever you are called to do in this world? We all have an assignment. Whatever your assignment is, if you commit yourself every day to doing what you are called to do so well that the dead, the living, or even the unborn couldn't do it any better, you ain't got no choice but to succeed. You have to excel. I hope that helps you a little bit. And I thank you for your question. Last question.
So, Brother Tavis, I appreciate the work that you do with Dr. West, and I want to invite you from the Breakfast Group. We are a nonprofit men's group here in Seattle. We just got a line item budget for the city of Seattle that the mayor has given us. The Breakfast Group is a nonprofit men's organization. We meet the second Thursday of the month. We have two primary programs. The first program is the All Achievers Award Ceremony, where we recognize students for any kind of advancement that they have increased in their school. It could be increased attendance, increasing in grades, and they get scholarships for that. Wonderful. The second program is the Taiwan on Luncheon that we have in a swanky downtown hotel. They get tied up with a mentor. There's a big time, you know, mentor speech during the luncheon, and they are taught how to tie a tie. The seniors get ties, actual graduation presents, and we consider it a rites of passage. Sure, and so absolutely. I want to invite you to, the next time you're in Seattle, make sure it's on a Thursday morning, meet at breakfast. We meet at First AME Church, 7:30 to 9 a.m., every second Thursday from June till September. And there's grits. So, you know.
Grits? That's yeah. Right. You said grits, I'll be there. Yeah. Yeah.
Second thing's third party, and this other one was the brother cut me off in doing the Boondock cartoon. I thought that was classic, the cartoon that had King. But your comments about third parties and about that. And the other one is about Malcolm, in the sense that nobody really knows about what Malcolm, when he changed after he came back from the Hajj.
Right.
I think that'd be an excellent book.
I appreciate that. Let me close by saying, before everybody moves, let me close by saying thank you. Again, I am always humbled when I come to this great. Let me get this out. I promise you. I appreciate the applause, but I want to say this from the heart. I am always humbled when I come to this city. I always make sure Seattle is on the tour list, as I said earlier, but I don't know what it is about this city that I have a love affair with. But every time I show up, you all show up, and I am humbled by your presence. Town Hall, thank you for having me. Seattle, I love you, and there ain't nothing you can do about it.
Tavis Smiley's latest book is Death of a King, the real story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year. KUOW listeners will be familiar with Tavis Smiley's work as a broadcaster, author, and advocate for justice, equal rights, and anti-poverty measures. His Tavis Smiley Foundation runs youth to leaders training workshops and conferences. It recently announced a $3 million four-year campaign called Ending Poverty, America's Silent Spaces. In 2009, Time magazine honored Smiley as one of the world's 100 most influential people. Harvard University awarded him the prestigious Du Bois Medal. Town Hall and Elliott Bay Book Company presented this talk by Tavis Smiley on September 30th, 2014, as part of their Civics series. The series is supported by the Boeing Company, the Real Networks Foundation, and the True Brown Foundation. Series media sponsorship is provided by The Stranger and KUOW. Thanks to Anna Tatashev for this recording. You can always podcast this program using your favorite aggregator, including KUOW's mobile app. And last but not least, If you love the series, please give us a good review. It helps more people find us. For Speakers Forum, KUW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.